Welcome to the first episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. In order to maintain the anonymity of the individuals concerned in these stories, names, places, and identifying features have been altered where appropriate. Therefore, any resemblance to individuals living or dead is purely coincidental. Although necessary details have been changed, these stories are based on actual events. They are real tragedies suffered by real people in real hospitals and clinics throughout England and Wales. I grew up in South London, where the sound of the sirens is never far away. At an early age, the fierce urgency of ambulances captured my imagination and drove me to learn what adventures they met. I wrote letters that were passed on to people of influence and was granted an invitation to see the inner workings of a hospital. As a 15-year-old boy, on my first day in a hospital, my nose was pressed up to a lead-lined glass screen. Behind it lay a man sprawled on his back, with his head clamped tightly between the arms of a vice. He smiled at me kindly, but his lucid eyes screamed. Under local anaesthetic, the attending doctor slipped a hollow needle into his groin. The hollow needle's point pierced through a pulsing femoral artery, which spat out blood into the air before the doctor quickly covered it. A wire-like device was passed through the hollow needle and into the vessel. The doctor's eyes flashed from the man's bloodied skin up to the monitor where an X-ray projection showed the device he had inserted. He pushed it further through the man's groin, and on the monitor I saw it ascend towards his chest. The wire-like device moved steadily forward through the path of an artery, along twig-like branches that fed into the trunk. The doctor's device hovered in an artery just by the heart, wavering in the current of the man's pulsing blood. The man smiled stiffly, looking upwards at the ceiling, but the doctor was not done. He twiddled the device and guided it on through the arteries of the neck, pushing further still until he entered the man's brain. That's when I saw it appear on the monitor, a throbbing blob of death, waiting insidiously to end the man's life. It was a vascular aneurysm, a solitary berry on the arterial twig of a pulsing tree that was never supposed to bear any fruit. The pressurized mass was swollen and ripe, ready to burst and end the man's life. With a few simple flicks, the doctor deployed a coil through his wire. The blob of death faded and disappeared into nothing. As quickly as that, the fate of that man had been decidedly altered. From that moment onward, I was propelled along a path from which nothing could stop me. I left my home at 18 to study at the University of Bristol, and by the time I was 23, I had completed my training. In the 5 brief years since, I have witnessed a degree of suffering I could only have imagined. Diseases have no mind and accidents have no intent, but there are other causes of illness that cannot be so blameless. Murderers and rapists, liars and thieves, all have the potential to disrupt people's lives and complicate a doctor's work. But when you meet with these people and the lives that they affect, you may soon learn a secret that at first seems disturbing. The worst transgressors amongst us still have hopes and dreams, loves and losses, fears and regrets. And when you look even closer, you may see something of yourself. We spend our whole lives learning just who we are, but if you don't know a sinner, you are still a stranger to yourself. These stories are born from the sinners and the sufferers, for they are the ones who have taught me the most. Coventry is a cathedral city in the West Midlands of England. It has been historically regarded as an industrial powerhouse, making major contributions to the British manufacturing industries throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. The Second World War proved a turning point in the city's fortunes, with the Luftwaffe firebombings devastating over 3/4 of the city's vital factory plants, as well as thousands of residential homes. The iconic cathedral that was built in the 14th century was struck in the bombings of November 1940. Devastated by the firebombs, it was leveled to the ground while the surrounding city burned. In the years that followed, Coventry underwent a gradual rebirth out from its former ashes. In that hopeful post-war era, Coventry enjoyed an economic boom as its motor and retail shopping industries thrived. The now prosperous city centre welcomed an influx of immigrants from the Commonwealth colonies to sustain its flourishing businesses. Its burgeoning population was affordably accommodated with a new style of concrete architecture, a design that has more recently been regarded as the concrete jungle. In the 1980s, Coventry suffered from a decline in the British motor industry, damaging whole communities with loss of income and employment. Coventry's turbulent story underwent its next turn as social unrest and organised crime rippled through the city. In Coventry's dense residential centre lived a 20-year-old girl called Ellie. She lived in a cramped apartment that she shared with her grandmother, parents, 2 younger sisters, and 1 older brother. They lived amidst a cluster of stark concrete towers, a district overshadowed by the notoriety of its gangs and the fear that they spread. Ellie's father was a violent man, a low-level criminal who dealt drugs from the door of his family home. When he wasn't in prison, Ellie's life was exposed to the desperate men and women whom her father drew a living from. She grew up in a home that was rife with conflict, an abusive father who bullied his wife, and her inspired brother, Greg, who did the same to his sisters. Ellie's days were spent working in a nearby grocery store. After getting back from work, she spent her evenings helping her mother to cook the family's dinner, while also caring for her infant sister, a 1-year-old called Chloe, whom Ellie dearly loved. Outside of her home, Ellie had been dating a local boy called Ben. They had met and grown up at a nearby school, and the two had known each other for most of their lives. Ben lived a similar cramped existence in a neighbouring tower block, just a stone's throw from Ellie. Ben had trained as a car mechanic, and he spent his days labouring for a small servicing business that was managed by his father. On occasion, Ben was inclined to borrow his boss's car. He would use it to drive Ellie outside of the city, into a countryside that is filled with rolling green fields and long-limbed oaks. They would find a quiet spot, away from prying eyes, to picnic in the meadows and make love beneath the trees. They would drift far away from the concrete of Coventry to dream up plans for their future, and enjoy each other's company in blissful solitude. When Ben proposed marriage, Ellie had the feeling that her life could finally start, but her joy was not shared by all of her family. Her father was enraged at what he regarded as her betrayal, and her brother Greg echoed his disgust. Their apparent concern was merely the reflection of their anxious realization that Ellie's independence negated their control over her. Ellie's mother and sisters expressed subdued excitement, but it was the reaction of her grandmother, Mary, that surprised her most of all. Using savings she'd kept hidden from her daughter and son-in-law, she gave Ellie the means to place a deposit on a flat and begin her life with Ben. Despite leaving the tower block that she'd lived in all her life, Ellie still found the time to visit her family regularly and to help around the home. She helped her mother with the shopping and played games with her sisters, just like she always had. Her father's temper softened, and in her absence, he realized his fondness for his eldest daughter and a begrudged tolerance of her fiancé, Ben. When a peaceful equilibrium settled on Ellie and Ben's lives, a swelling in Ellie's belly began an unwavering growth. Ellie had become pregnant. Ben was overjoyed at the prospect of becoming both a husband and now a father, and their community of family celebrated with them. But for Ellie, things were different, and she knew in herself that something was wrong. Some anatomists regard there as being three human anatomical forms: the male, the female, and the pregnant female. At the age of 20, Ellie's mind and body faced a unique test. We grow up as children, accustomed to change as our bodies transform and we discover the world around us. And yet as adults we come to expect a certain consistency from our physical bodies. This is not an expectation that pregnancy respects. No biological change is quite as dramatic as those experienced by an expectant mother. Over the course of 9 months, a woman's body will transform. To keep the fetus healthy, an optimal blood supply to the placenta is essential. The mother's blood volume is increased and yet simultaneously diluted, while the heart compensates by beating that much harder, encouraging blood to be pulsed through the placenta and onto the fetus. Sometimes these changes to the cardiovascular state will cause excess fluid to pool in the expectant mother's ankles. During pregnancy, this is normal, and it is one of many symptoms that is commonly experienced. Despite these changes to the heart and the blood, the process of evolution has taught our biology something of the risks that childbirth may incur, in particular, the risk of a life-threatening bleed. The pregnant blood adapts, and the microscopic clotting factors that circulate within it are significantly enhanced, allowing clots to form with greater speed to stem the flow of an uncontrolled bleed. This will protect her should a life-threatening hemorrhage affect the mother during childbirth. An unwanted side effect of this necessary reaction is the increased chance of forming clots in the veins, which can present with pain and a redness of the skin. Such an event is known as a deep vein thrombosis, and it should not be ignored, as the clot can be displaced, moving through flowing blood to cause a blockage in the lungs. There are countless other changes that occur during pregnancy, and most of them are driven by proteins called hormones. Hormones are molecules that are released into the blood, allowing communication between different organs. The hormone known as relaxin is perhaps the most appropriately named. It relaxes the muscles and tendons of the body, which give pregnant women their characteristic gait. One of the purposes of relaxin is to widen the pelvis in preparation for the child that must soon pass through it. All of this is to say nothing of the social changes that a pregnancy will cause, which together with the hormones put the pregnant woman through the most unique pressures. Once the child is born, the hormonal changes switch dramatically again, and the mother must contend with another transformation as the body returns to its former state. And if all of that is not enough, the mother is now tasked with the care of a child. It is hardly surprising that some form of mood disturbance is reported to affect as much as 85% of pregnant women, while postnatal depression affects up to 15%. Pre-existing mental health issues are well-recognized risk factors for mood disturbance during pregnancy, and all women are encouraged to seek early help should symptoms of depression or anxiety arise. Sometimes circumstance can mask the early symptoms, and the help that is needed is not forthcoming. Sometimes the changes can be more insidious and surpass the symptoms that are commonly seen. Sometimes the changes will elicit a more sinister underlying pathology. For Ellie, it began with a tearfulness and a level of anxiety that was not unreasonable for an expectant first-time mother. But then her behavior changed. She stopped attending work, and she isolated herself at home. Her family would visit her, but her father would not. In his place, he sent Ellie's brother, Greg, who visited by himself to convey their patriarch's unforgiving exasperation. Those visits to Ellie became increasingly volatile, and Ellie's mental health only deteriorated further. Encouraged by Ben, Ellie was seen by her doctor, who referred her on to a psychiatric clinic that specialized in the mental health of expectant mothers. A consultant psychiatrist called Paul came with a junior doctor, Kate, to see Ellie in her home. Ben answered the door and welcomed the two doctors into their pleasant studio apartment. The space was small, but it was comfortable and well-ordered. The furniture and floors were tidy and clean, and their possessions were organized into cabinets and cupboards that were built into the walls. Ben brought the two to Ellie, who lay in her bed, exhausted and sad. She rubbed her eyes and sat up, greeting the two doctors and thanking them for coming. Although she spoke coherently throughout the medical interview, she interrupted herself on several occasions with a series of abrupt and pained facial expressions. Some were little more than a twitch, but others rose up into grotesque facial contortions. On one such occasion, her breathing quickened. While staring at her abdomen, she raised a closed fist up, trembling above her, primed to bring it down heavily upon herself. But then the fist relaxed and flopped harmlessly to her side. These tics would distract her for several seconds at a time. She would make a little gasp and blink her eyes quickly before returning to the conversation as if nothing had happened. By the end of their consultation, Ellie's face was glowing and tiny beads of sweat had formed along her brow. Little muscles around her face twitched involuntarily, but Ellie was still capable of a tremulous smile that she gladly showed the two attending doctors. Paul and Kate brought their meeting to a close. They started Ellie on an antidepressant with a plan to meet again in 2 weeks' time. Depression in pregnancy is a well-recognized phenomenon that the attending psychiatrists were well used to seeing. But there was much about Ellie's case that had unsettled the two doctors. Although Ellie and Ben came from impoverished backgrounds, they were both well supported by Ben's doting family and Ellie's mother and grandmother. They also both had stable jobs, which provided a steady income, and both seemed well suited to a family life together. Ellie's case followed a pattern that many other young women had painfully experienced, but the extent of Ellie's deterioration did not entirely make sense. The junior doctor, Kate, discussed the case with Paul, her consultant, and they considered what information may have been missing from her story. Paul reassured her that no clinical history was ever complete, and that their plan for treatment and follow-up was reasonable in the circumstances. When the 2 weeks came and went, both doctors were eager to see how Ellie had managed in their absence. They rang on the front doorbell, as they had once before, but on this occasion the door did not open. They tried the bell several times and called her name through the letterbox, discreetly explaining who they were and why they'd come, wary of any neighbours who might happen to overhear. After a while, they heard a scuffling through the door. It made a soft click, opening just a fraction. Kate pushed gently on the unlocked door. It creaked open to reveal Ellie standing in her underwear, with a distant look in her bloodshot eyes. Her expansile body was barely contained in the clothes she had on, but before even noticing her, the doctors were aware of the temperature in the flat. An autumnal chill gushed in through open windows. The cold, wet air freely pervaded the poorly lit apartment, which was strewn with magazines, clothes, and dirty crockery. Kate rushed into the flat and instinctively went to Ellie to help her cover up. As she wrapped a blanket around her, Kate gasped at the coldness of Ellie's skin. Ellie trembled at the cold, and yet she didn't seem to notice it. They closed all the windows and turned on a light. They pulled up 2 chairs and saw Ellie in her bed. "He likes my body," Ellie began. "He likes the way my breasts have grown." Paul and Kate were both taken aback by this unexpected comment, but both held their nerve and remained silent where they sat, using the opportunity to keep Ellie talking. That comment was the start of Ellie's admission. While Ben was out at work, she had been sleeping with another man. His name was Greg, and he was also Ellie's brother. Ellie shook off her lethargy with the blankets wrapped around her, gripped by a sudden, terrible urgency. She sat up in her bed and desperately pleaded with the 2 doctors, begging them not to tell her secret to Ben. The 2 attending doctors nodded in assent and continued the interview. Ellie was racked by guilt for her perceived adultery, but in reality, she had been systematically raped since she was 10 years of age by the older brother who should have been protecting her. Although now an adult, she had been ruthlessly battered into an imitation of consent through Greg's threat of further violence and strong social influence. Despite moving out to live with Ben, Greg had not been perturbed. The frequency of attacks lessened, but they hadn't stopped entirely. When Ellie had withdrawn with depression, Greg had resorted to assaulting Ellie in her marital home. "The baby," Paul asked. "Is it his?" Ellie was not able to deny the possibility. They heard the front door being shut and turned to see Ben in his greasy work overalls. He greeted all 3, then looked hopelessly at the flat and diligently set to work, clearing out the mess. Ellie made it clear that the consultation was now over. The 2 doctors made amendments to the antidepressant medication, discussed their next appointment, and left. They were bound by confidentiality and they had to respect that, but there was one detail in Ellie's story that brought hope as well as fear. Ellie's brother Greg lived with Ellie's 2 younger sisters. Jenny was 15 and Chloe was just 1. This sudden realization gave them legitimate concern over the safety of the 2 girls. They didn't even stop to discuss it with Ellie. Paul made a call to the local safeguarding team. The plan was set in motion, and an investigation began. The safeguarding investigation sent shockwaves throughout Ellie's family. Greg was arrested while police collected evidence. But sadly, the timing was not soon enough. While living with her family, Ellie had used her own body to shield Greg from their younger sisters. Despite moving away, Ellie knew what would happen if she didn't keep Greg satisfied. She had worked hard to maintain their sexual relationship, to prevent Greg's eyes from wandering to their sisters. What Ellie didn't know is that Greg's abuse of Jenny, aged only 15, was already well underway. Ellie's sacrifice had been in vain, because Greg's perversion had been utterly insatiable. Greg went to prison for the systematic and simultaneous abuse of his two younger sisters. The protective police presence proved vital for Ellie's mother too. She reported her own abuse at the hands of Ellie's father. For his various crimes against his own family, as well as to the public, Ellie's father was arrested along with his rapist son. Freed from their own prison, the surviving women moved away to start somewhere new, in a place they could feel safe. But Ellie's next appointment with the doctors was never to transpire. The following week, Ben returned home to a freezing chill that struck him from the moment that he opened the front door. Their home had been transformed by an unforeseen chaos. Whole cupboards had been emptied, with all their possessions scattered throughout the small flat. A wall was scarred with marks left from shattered plates. Beneath the marks were the remains of all the china that they owned. A small kitchen knife was embedded in the plastering of the wall. Ben didn't fail to notice that the blade was stained red. Amidst the chaos, he saw Ellie. She lay naked on the floor beside the open oven door. The oven billowed out a glowing orange heat that rallied against the air that blew in through the windows. Ellie's swollen belly was crusted with dried blood. Ben rushed in towards her, all the while her eyes blinking mindlessly at the ceiling. A red MUM had been carved into her abdomen, so that baby can see it, so it knows I'm its mum, Ellie said to Ben earnestly. When Ben fussed and cried at the incoherent horror, Ellie struck him around the face as he tried to lift her from the floor. I think I'll stay by the oven, Ben, Ellie said gently. It's so nice and warm here. If baby ever feels the chill, we can always stick it in there. That was enough for Ben. He called the emergency services, and Ellie was taken swiftly to accident and emergency. She was treated for hypothermia and blood loss from her wounds. Thankfully, her self-inflicted injuries were only skin deep. Once the A&E doctors had stabilized Ellie, she was transferred to a mental health team who managed her for an acute psychotic episode. Specifically, Ellie was suffering from a condition called puerperal psychosis. She was treated in a psychiatric hospital with powerful antipsychotic medication. Simultaneously, she was managed by the obstetric team, who closely monitored the health of the unborn child. A decision was made on Ellie's behalf. Her doctors determined that she was not well enough to give birth naturally, so the baby was delivered by cesarean section. Ellie gave birth to a healthy baby girl. Ellie's case was unusual in the onset of her psychosis, which had come on before the birth of her baby. The name of her condition, puerperal psychosis, is also known as postnatal psychosis, or psychosis occurring after the birth of the baby. That Ellie's condition had preceded the birth of her child confused the attending doctors, who weren't used to seeing the condition progress in this sequence. But as Ellie recovered and became aware of her brother's conviction and the safety that it afforded her, more detail in her story began to emerge. Her upbringing in a home that was so full of conflict meant Ellie was no stranger to suffering in silence. And shortly before she moved away to live with her fiancé Ben, she carried an illness unbeknownst to any other. The baby she had just delivered by cesarean section was not the first child to Ellie. She carried her first to just over 17 weeks before it died unexpectedly in her womb. During this time that she suffered in secret, Ellie was still living with her dysfunctional family. Her relationship with Ben was just beginning to blossom, but her abuse at home had been more prevalent than ever. It was her doctor's belief that this first unsuccessful pregnancy was the real trigger of her psychosis, which just happened to coincide with the start of her next pregnancy. While Ellie continued her recovery in a psychiatric hospital, Ben cared for their baby with the help of his family as well as Ellie's mother. He took the baby to see Ellie as frequently as he could, and with every day that passed, her mental health improved. But there was something that Ben was unable to ignore. Through all their pain and all their suffering, Ben was as devoted as he could be to both Ellie and the baby, but he was racked by a fear that the child was not his own. He took advice from his GP as well as from his family before resolving that he needed the clarity of a paternity test. Ben made the decision, and 2 weeks later he had the result. Ben was the child's father. The result of Ben's paternity test accelerated Ellie's recovery. In time, she had recovered enough to be discharged home, to be with Ben and their healthy baby daughter. They named their daughter Mary and fulfilled their dream of marriage the following year. Together, they resolved to live out lives free from secrets and to raise Mary in a home rich with the love and security that had been lacking from Ellie's life. These stories deal with themes that will be challenging for some. If you're in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything.